From the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, this is NIH Research Radio. Welcome to episode 40 of NIH Research Radio, with news about the ongoing medical research at the National Institutes of Health, the nation's medical research agency. I'm your host, Bill Schmalfeld. Coming up on this edition, September is National Cholesterol Education Month. I'll sit down for a chat with Dr. Griffin Rogers, director of the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases, to discuss how controlling your cholesterol is a vital component in preventing the cardiovascular disease that can come following a diagnosis of diabetes. Wally Akinso will be along with some good ideas on how you can better communicate with your doctor. For the first time in a decade, there's been a comprehensive update of the National Asthma Guidelines. And we'll take a look at some fascinating research we first reported on 2 years ago that talks about using saliva for diagnostic purposes, much in the same way we currently use blood and other tissues. But first, some new information that shows a change in how Americans get their information about health and cancer. That's next on NIH Research Radio.
I'll never get used to these 10-mile runs. They are taking so much time out of my day.
Are you training for a marathon or something?
Diabetes runs in my family, and I heard if you lose lots of weight, you can prevent it. So I started running like crazy, and I cut my calories big time.
Oh, get real. You don't have to knock yourself out to prevent diabetes. My doctor said it's the small lifestyle changes you make that matter, because it's easier to stick to them.
Wow, really?
It worked for me. 6 months ago, I started walking a lot and I stopped eating the fried stuff. I've lost 10 pounds. My doctor said I'm doing great.
I'll have to ask my doctor about this. I'd love to get my life back.
Talk to your healthcare provider. Losing a small amount of weight by being active 30 minutes, 5 days a week, and eating healthier can prevent type 2 diabetes. To get your free game plan for preventing type 2 diabetes, call 1-800-438-5383. This is a message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the National Diabetes Education Program.
Although the internet remains a frequent first source for Americans seeking healthcare information, a new study indicates that the public's trust in online material about health has declined. At the same time, more folks are expressing confidence in the information they get from healthcare professionals. The report, Cancer Communication, Health Information National Trends Survey 2003 and 2005, is a survey done every other year and sponsored by the National Cancer Institute at the National Institutes of Health. Dr. Bradford Hesse, chief of the Health Communications and Informatics Research Branch at the NCI, explains the results.
People look to their physicians first and foremost as a trusted source of information. They went to the internet because that was their first choice. But when they got there, what we're finding is that they're not quite as convinced that the information they have is credible. In fact, it's driving them to go to their physicians that much more. So we're seeing an increase in people going to their physicians now than we saw from 2003, and an increase in trust in their physicians.
Dr. Hesse explained why folks continue to use the internet as their first source for getting healthcare info, even though they are trusting it less.
In the beginning, I think the very first phase, people who were going online and getting access to health information online were doing it in kind of a self-advocating way. So they would go to try and fill in the gaps from anywhere they could. Providers are now recognizing that they can meet an important need by putting information out themselves that is vetted and credible for their subscribers and their clients and their patients to use. We're seeing slight increases from 2003 to 2005, but we're going to be seeing even more of that as time progresses.
Use of the internet as a source for cancer-specific information remained relatively unchanged during the study period. Yet, the number of people using the internet to communicate with their healthcare provider or their provider's office, using email to ask questions or set up appointments, for instance, increased from 7% in 2003 to 10% in 2005. Where can you get information geared toward helping you communicate with your doctor? Wally Akinso has the details.
How do you communicate with your doctor about a sensitive issue? What if you feel rushed during your appointment? How can you get the most out of your visit with your healthcare provider? Being able to communicate openly, comfortably, and assertively with your doctor can help you make good health decisions and stay well. But some older people shy away from this approach and hesitate to ask questions or take the doctor's time. You can find techniques to communicate with your doctor by checking out the Talking with Your Doctor topic on the website nihseniorhealth.gov. The website is a joint effort of the National Institute on Aging and the National Library of Medicine. Dr. Judith Salerno, NIA's deputy director, said most people know that communicating with their doctor is important to their care, especially as they age and are more likely to have health conditions and treatments to discuss. But the key is to know how to have that conversation.
We would like to encourage people to be assertive about their health care, which means being prepared. After all, you're part of the health care team and you're the key member of that team. Make lists of the questions that you might have for your physician. List your medications and any assistive devices like canes and walkers that you might use and not necessarily bring with you. Be prepared. Remember that your time with your physician is valuable time and may be very limited, so cut down on the small talk and get to the point of what is important for you and your doctor to discuss.
Dr. Salerno said she's optimistic about how the tips on the site will be received by the older community.
I hope that looking at the information provided on this website will help people communicate with their healthcare providers openly, comfortably, and assertively so that they can make good healthcare decisions and they can take an active role in their own care.
Once again, the website is www.nihseniorhealth.gov. This is Wally Akinso at the National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland.
When we come back, I'll talk with Dr. Griffin Rogers, director of the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases, about why diabetes patients need to bone up on their ABCs. That's next on NIH Research Radio.
No doubt about it, you're on your way to the top. You're young, you've got the education, you've got the talent. So what's the harm in a little celebrating? I mean, what could possibly go wrong?
Come on, tough guy, chug it. Be a man.
Chug, 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 chug.
You are under arrest for disorderly conduct. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you.
Please step out of the car, sir. I'm now going to proceed with a field sobriety test.
What could possibly go wrong? Plenty. That's what. The path to success is tough enough for young adults. Why make it even tougher? If alcohol is a problem for you or someone you know, visit www.niaaa.nih.gov for more information. Brought to you by this station and the National Institutes of Health, an agency of the United States Department of Health and Human Services.
Welcome back to NIH Research Radio. In the studio with us, Dr. Griffin P. Rogers, director of the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases. Dr. Rogers, welcome aboard.
Good to be here.
We're in the month of September here. It's National Cholesterol Education Month, and folks are going to be focusing on ways to modify their diet, think about activities, ways to avoid heart disease. But it's not just cholesterol that folks need to be worrying about this month. There are 20 million adults in the United States, more than that actually, with diabetes, and that also puts them at increased risk for developing heart disease and stroke. Could you give us a bit of a primer on what happens to the human body in diabetes that increases the risk for stroke and heart disease?
Absolutely. And your point is very well taken. There are over 20 million Americans in this country today with diabetes. That's 7% of the population who are living with diabetes. And this puts them at great risk for developing cardiovascular disease, such as heart attacks and strokes. In fact, 2 out of 3 people with diabetes will die of either a heart attack or a stroke. But it's important to keep in mind that it's not only important to regulate the blood sugar, but also the blood pressure and the cholesterol, as you've indicated. And therefore, it's important in the campaign that we have out for people with diabetes to know their ABCs.
What are those ABCs that folks with diabetes need to consider?
Extremely important to know their ABCs. The A stands for A1C, or hemoglobin A1C, which is a simple blood test to determine what the average blood sugar level is for the previous 3 months. The B stands for blood pressure, and the C stands for cholesterol. In patients with diabetes, we like their A1C level to reach a target somewhere below 7. The blood pressure, of course, the target is known, but in people that have concomitant diabetes, we like their blood pressure values to be below 130 over 80. And then finally, cholesterol. There's so-called good cholesterol. There's bad cholesterol. The bad cholesterol, or the LDL, we like the target value for that LDL in patients with diabetes to be less than 100. When patients with diabetes go to their providers, we want them to ask them a few questions. What are my ABCs? What should my goals for the ABCs be? And how can I help in reaching those targets that you've set? Let me put in a little plug now. You can get more information those targets by visiting our website, www.yourdiabetesinfo.org, or you can call a toll-free number, 1-888-693-NDEP, and learn more about the ABCs from our National Diabetes Education Program, which is called Control Your Diabetes for Life. It's a campaign that's been very effective.
We'll make sure we have those links on the transcript to this podcast, which folks can also find online at nih.gov. This is all the workings of the NDEP, the National Diabetes Education Program. Tell us a little bit about that program and your efforts to increase general awareness about diabetes prevention.
Well, the National Diabetes Education Program was a program that's now celebrating its 10th anniversary. It was founded in 1997 following some major research showing that controlling one's blood sugar could quite substantially reduce many of the complications, the heart complications, the complications associated with blindness, associations with end-stage kidney disease. And based upon that evidence, the NDEP came out with these awareness campaigns to control your diabetes for life. Subsequently, we were involved in a study in patients who are at high risk for developing diabetes, a diabetes prevention program, which clearly showed that a number of interventions, most notably an intensive lifestyle adjustment, could substantially reduce the risk of people at high risk for developing diabetes to go on to develop diabetes. And so a part of the message of NDEP not only was how to control your diabetes if you have it, but if you're at high risk for it, how can you go about preventing the diabetes? And so much of what you can read about in our campaign, either through the toll-free number that I mentioned before or through that website, will tell you the simple steps on an individual basis, on a community basis, and a larger basis to try to achieve those evidence-based objectives.
It seems like there's more information about diabetes out there now for general consumption by the public, but yet your own stats show that Americans with diabetes have increased from 17 million in 2002 to 20.8 million in the most recent numbers. To what do you attribute that increase in patients with diabetes?
There are a number of factors that have been associated with that increase. Number one, we know that the risk factors for diabetes are increasing age. And I think one major contributor to that is really the aging, the baby boomers in our populations getting older, which would increase that risk factor. A second major risk factor for diabetes is actually an increased propensity in certain racial and ethnic groups. And so I think a second factor contributing is really the change in the demographics in the United States that we're seeing today. Largely, though, and no pun intended, a major contributor to that has been overweight, almost an epidemic of overweight and obesity that we're seeing in this country. But not only that, the decrease in physical activity. And so it's really those three factors sort of coming together that are really contributing to this increase in number of patients. That's sort of the bad news. The good news, though, is that there are things that can be done to either diminish your chances of going on to develop diabetes or, in fact, if you have it, to diminish the likelihood that you'll develop these complications that we spoke about.
Well, there's some good takeaway messages then for the folks listening to this podcast. Actually, a large portion of the battle would be managing those ABCs we talked about earlier.
Absolutely.
What are some of the tips that you would suggest for our listeners to, if they don't have diabetes yet, to really increase the odds of never coming down with it?
There are certain things that you can certainly avoid. Smoking is one of them. Of course, we have to eat, but we don't necessarily have to smoke. And so smoking doubles your risk for cardiovascular disease if you have diabetes. And even if you don't have diabetes, it increases substantially. And so that's something that we certainly tell people to avoid. To manage really the ABCs and to reduce your risk of these complications, we want and we encourage people to reach and stay at a healthy weight because, again, being overweight and obese is a risk factor. Get at least 30 to 60 minutes of physical activity each day. Being physically active, such as dancing or walking or doing household chores most days of the week, can really lower one's blood pressure, help one lose weight, and has many other positive beneficial attributes. People should eat foods that are low in saturated fats, trans fats, or cholesterol. Minimize the salt and added sugars that one takes in. Eating more fiber, choosing grains and fruits and vegetables, or dry peas or beans, or other things that not only in patients at high risk for developing diabetes diminish their risk, but even in patients that have existing diabetes, this can really control a lot of their overall blood sugar control during the day. As I mentioned before, stop smoking, because smoking increases these risk factors for cardiovascular disease. If you are on medication, take the medication as directed. Ask your doctor about taking a daily aspirin. And then finally, ask your friends and family members to help you to manage your diabetes. It's often said that it sometimes takes a village. This is something that really will assist very greatly in being able to achieve and maintain the goals that one sets for oneself, if the friends and family members are also involved.
Get your whole team involved, basically.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And, of course, all that information you just shared with us, Dr. Rogers, is on the National Diabetes Education Program website, www.yourdiabetesinfo, that's all one word, yourdiabetesinfo.org, and available on the telephone at 888-963-NDEP, where you can learn more about the ABCs of diabetes through the NDEP Control Your Diabetes for Life campaign. Anything else you'd like to add while you're here?
This is a project that is really an excellent example of a public-private partnership. We have over 200 public and private members involved in the NDEP. Of course, it's run largely by the NIH and the Centers for Disease Control, but there are a number of participants. We try to make sure that the message that we get out, because there's so many media venues that people are bombarded with every day, we want to make sure that the message that they hear has been field tested, if you would. There's a lot of social marketing going into this. We have a number of groups that make sure that the message that's being conveyed is a message that's likely to stick and resonate with people, because unfortunately, you won't be able to change people's behavior if they don't hear what you're saying. To go to the website and to the toll-free number that you mentioned, you'll really see practical examples of ways that people can very effectively make decisions that can improve their health. The overall goal of this program is really to reduce illness and death associated with diabetes and its complications.
And there's the twofold approach of taking measures to keep yourself from developing the disease and then how to manage the disease if you should happen to develop it. Dr. Griffin P. Rogers, director of the NIH's National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases, thanks for being our guest today here on NIH Research Radio.
Thanks for having me.
When we come back, information about the first comprehensive update of the National Asthma Guidelines in a decade.
That's next on NIH Research Radio.
Recent studies have shown that diabetes can be prevented, and the results are even greater with my patients over age 60. Losing a small amount of weight by getting some physical activity, 30 minutes, 5 days a week, and eating healthier has proven to be effective. Listen to the great results from one of my patients.
I had to learn how to change my way of eating because diabetes ran in my family, and I wanted to take control of it before I got it.
Having diabetes in your family and being overweight puts you at a higher risk for type 2 diabetes. These risks increase with age, which is why it is important to take your first step today.
There was a time I could not go from my basement up to my bedroom, but now I can, and that means a lot to me.
It's not too late to prevent diabetes. Join my patients who are taking small steps and gaining big rewards.
For more information on how to prevent type 2 diabetes, call 1-800-438-5383. This is a message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the National Diabetes Education Program.
There's been a change in the official thinking about asthma. This update, announced by the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute at the National Institutes of Health, represents the first comprehensive change to the asthma guidelines in a decade. The Expert Panel Report 3, Guidelines for the Diagnosis and Management of Asthma, provides new guidance for selecting treatment based on a patient's individual needs and the level of asthma control. The report, also known as EPR3, emphasizes that while asthma can be controlled, the condition can change over time and differs among individuals and age groups. That makes it important to regularly monitor the patient's level of asthma control, adjusting the treatment as needed. EPR3 takes a new approach to assessing and monitoring asthma by using multiple measures of a patient's current level of impairment and future risk, emphasizing that some patients can still be at high risk for frequent exacerbations even if their asthma causes them few day-to-day problems. The report also confirms the importance of teaching patients how to self-monitor their asthma, to use a written asthma action plan, including instructions for daily treatment, and how to recognize and handle it when asthma gets worse. Also in the report, using multiple approaches to limit exposure to allergens and other things that can make asthma worse, as well as information on other common conditions and how treating those conditions, such as stress, sinusitis, overweight or obesity, and obstructive sleep apnea, may also help improve control of a patient's asthma. For more information on these and other changes to the National Asthma Guidelines, log on to www.nhlbi.nih.gov. Finally, a fascinating story we first aired in 2005 about how it might be possible to diagnose many diseases not with a blood test, but with your saliva. Calvin Jackson has the report.
Most people are familiar with the concept of going to a doctor and having blood drawn to study various markers, such as cholesterol or the level of sugar in their blood. But researchers have found that many of the substances that can be analyzed in blood can also be detected and analyzed using saliva. Speaking at a lecture in the 2005 Medicine for the Public Lecture Series, Dr. Lawrence Tabak, director of the National Institute of Dental and Craniofacial Research, says there are many instances where using saliva as the diagnostic medium of choice would make sense.
For example, if you have individuals who are very infirmed, if you have a need to do collection within the community, one day with appropriate tests, if people wanted to monitor themselves within their own home, it might be more reasonable to use saliva rather than blood in those cases. What we are trying to do is we're trying to come to a day where we would have small devices that would be inserted in the mouth that would allow for a continuous surveillance of different markers of health and disease. So then, rather than waiting to go to a physician or a dentist for a particular test, you would in fact have continuous feedback, a sort of health surveillance, if you will. And it's not that far off. The bioengineers are working very hard with the oral biologists and are coming up with devices that are getting smaller and smaller. And so I think the this small lab on a chip inserted in the mouth is not that far off, certainly within the next decade.
Salivary diagnostics could have benefits far beyond medicine and dentistry as well. Law enforcement agencies could employ saliva tests in the field to determine rapidly whether a person is intoxicated or has recently used illegal drugs. These tests may also be beneficial in determining exposures to environmental, occupational, and biological substances. This is Calvin Jackson, the National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland.
And with that, we come to the end of this episode of NIH Research Radio. Please join us on Friday, September 21st, when episode 41 of NIH Research Radio will be available for download. These stories are also available on the NIH Radio News Service website, www.nih.gov/news/radio. Our daily 60-second feature, NIH Health Matters, is heard on radio stations nationwide, as well as on XM Satellite Radio, the HealthStar Radio Network, and online at federalnewsradio.com. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please feel free to contact me. That info is right there on the podcast webpage. The email address, ws159h@nih.gov. Once again, that email address is ws159h@nih.gov. I'm your host, Bill Schmalfelt. NIH Research Radio is a presentation of the NIH Radio News Service, part of the News Media Branch, Office of Communications and Public Liaison, in the Office of the Director at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, an agency of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.